If you are looking to elevate your leadership and drive your nonprofit forward, I invite you to subscribe to the Successful Nonprofits newsletter. Every week, I curate exclusive, shareworthy content that sparks inspiration, innovation, and conversation. From the latest trends to timeless advice, the weekly email newsletter is your all-access pass to a treasure trove of resources. But receiving the newsletter is not just about staying informed. It's also about getting our best content first. Subscribers get first access to our newest downloadable templates designed to propel your leadership and amplify your impact. And that's not all, my friend. We are constantly working on new ways to support you and your mission. So as a subscriber, you'll get updates on our latest projects, opportunities to participate in surveys, and a say in the topics that we tackle next. You will essentially get me as a consultant, coach, and confidant in your inbox, ready to help you navigate the challenges of nonprofit leadership. So if you're an executive director, board chair, or a nonprofit leader who believes in making a difference, join me as a newsletter subscriber. Visit successfulnonprofits.com/newsletter to sign up today. And now, friend, let me take you to the episode you've downloaded. Welcome to the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dolph Goldenberg. In today's episode, friend, we are going to be chatting with Russ Finkelstein about advice for founders and new executive directors. And in reality, this is really just advice for leaders. But, you know, we figured if we called it advice for founders and new executive directors, more people would be like, yeah, let me see what that one's about. But if you think of yourself as a leader in the organization, this is definitely an episode you want to give a listen to. Russ Finkelstein is what you might think of as the opposite of your high school guidance counselor. Russ is a career coach, a social entrepreneur, and an advisor to founders. He is currently the director of coaching with the Roddenberry Fellowship and a coach in residence with Starting Block Fellowship. He also, by the way, was a founder of the noted careers website, idealist.org. And if you have been in the nonprofit sector professionally for any period of time, you've gone to idealist.org to go and see if you could find a job that might be a great fit for you. Russ was chosen as a Generation Z and LGBTQ influencer by LinkedIn, and you might also have read some of his work because he has a career column with the Washington Post. Hey, Russ, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. That was an exceedingly long introduction. I think I'm way too busy. I've done far too much.
I almost extended that introduction a little bit because I loved the headline or tagline or whatever they call it on LinkedIn. Your headline or tagline is helping outliers find their way in work and life.
It is. And I mean, the thing is, the large number of folks ultimately identify as outliers when you kind of dig in deep. But yeah, I think I most often connect to folks who are having that moment of feeling like I don't quite fit in.
And that's a moment that take some amount of courage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the I was having a conversation, I was coming back from a conference recently, and there was this conversation about when you grew comfortable with being who you are. And I said, well, a lot of it was like, I had no ability to not be this. I was like, I could try to, like, there's this, you know, a supposed like mammalian ability to, you know, to fit in and to shift and deal well in different kinds of environments. And I'm pretty much just very, very much the same in most places, which is useful in the sense that people always know what they're getting, and that there's authenticity there, and less useful when there's a person you encounter who has a strong sense of propriety and feels like there's a set of ways where everyone's supposed to act as a leader. And so I think very often I'm particularly drawn to leaders who are trying to figure out how to show up and be their authentic selves in a world that's not accepting of them. Look at that. I actually made a segue there. Wasn't my intention, but see, if I talk long enough, I'll close the circle. Yeah.
Well, I will share with you, Russ, I'm not at all surprised by this because, you know, you and I first met, we were working on a board recruitment project for a client, and you were one of the folks that I'd reached out to say, hey, who might you know that would be good for this board? And literally from the very first few minutes of the phone call, I just kept thinking, by the way, look how old I am, phone call. Very first few minutes of the Zoom, it was not a phone call, but the very first few minutes of the Zoom, I remember thinking, I got to get Russ on the podcast. Russ is a gifted coach and also really gifted with words. So I'm not at all surprised that you could bring it full circle.
I cannot promise that for the rest of this conversation. Let's just say maybe I sort of did my best work in the first 5 minutes. And from now, it's just, you know, it's unfinished circle after unfinished circle. So.
Well, I guess what we might then do, just to fulfill on that promise, let's take a step out of the circle we're in and move to a new circle that we might not finish. So I know before we started recording, you and I were just having a little bit of a conversation about what we might talk about. And you were talking about the importance for leaders to have the courage to start anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, I think there's so much fear. I think very often leaders... people, especially the nonprofit sector, often start something because it's incredibly important to them. It's had an impact on their family, someone that they care deeply about. Perhaps they've personally felt it in a really strong way. And there is this massive fear of having to be perfect. There's a fear of officially stating the fact that you're going to do that thing. And it's hard to get past that. I also feel like there's this thing around being fearless, which I think is ridiculous. I think fear, there's a reason why we have fear, and people who say ignore it often are not like dealing with the very realities of, hey, I'm fearful that I may not have enough money to pay my rent, or I'm like, there are real reasons why fear exists. And I think that's why often having, you know, whether you're working with a coach or a friend or a colleague that you really trust that can have an authentic conversation with, that I think fear makes sense because we're all trying to survive. And it makes sense to be afraid of doing something that feels daunting. And it's about figuring out, why is this thing daunting? So when I encounter anybody, and this is honestly, even whether it's like starting up something or it's deciding to go and get your, you know, your graduate degree or undergraduate degree in your 40s or 50s, I'm like, that's amazing. Like, it's courageous to do to shift from doing the thing that you've been doing. And I just appreciate that. I appreciate the risk that it takes and the clarity of that moment decision. And so whenever we can show up to help folks feel slightly less afraid and share with them, I understand why you're experiencing fear, and here is the way to perhaps move past that or to figure out if this can still work for you. That's always the thing that I love to do.
I think it is so often fear that paralyzes us as leaders. And I know you've mentioned you like to help people figure out how to move past that. What can people do to actually go beyond just, okay, I'm afraid and I don't want to do anything, to I'm afraid, let me mitigate the risk?
A lot of it is just is really figuring out the why of it. And for most of us, no matter how thoughtful and analytical we are, having someone else who is not you, who is not in the weeds of you and all of your stuff that you carry, and who has certain self-perceptions, is helpful. As I said, it doesn't have to be like a paid coach. It could be someone that you know who's been a mentor in the past, but someone that you respect, that you communicate well with, they don't have baggage with. You know, sometimes we could dismiss people based on prior things in a relationship. And so I think a big part of it is just figuring out where we get support. I think the other big thing for me is always just being really thoughtful and intentional about goals and, you know, taking those like small risks, those small movements that move you in a direction that build confidence and the belief in the possibility of creating something or making a shift.
Can you give an example?
Sure. So let's say, would you prefer an example around starting up a thing or about making a career shift?
So, you know, why don't we do an example around starting up a thing, whether it's a new organization, a new program, whatever?
Yeah. So, I mean, so whenever I started to think an idealist, I often had this notion. So my head naturally goes towards voids. What is the thing that's not there? What is the obvious thing that should be there that would help people? And I would realize that there's, of course, that should exist. And then my next thing would be, well, why doesn't it? It's obvious to me. And so I'd have a group of people that I trusted to say, hey, I have this idea about this thing. What do you think about this? Can you tell me if you know whether this has happened or not before? Anything that even kind of does parts of this? Do you have any sense of why this wouldn't be successful? So a lot of it, like, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily you have to go to the negative, but that's, how I was raised. Was to go towards that, like more critical, like it's not work out. But I would go over time towards this vetting thing. So there are folks who come when it comes to decision making with very different issues. So there are the gut people who I often work with and just create structure, structure, structure. Love to create structure. I unfortunately fall in some respects in the other category, which is the perfect information category. So I have to work very hard to recognize that I have enough information to make my best decision. So I think very often it's around who you have to support you that you trust and that you can trust over time, and then working to set up a schedule with specific goals and a timeline, and having an accountability partner to move you along. Like those are, I think those are kind of the basic ways to get started. And if you're realizing the goals and you're seeing the progress that you wanted, that usually will build momentum, that can help you believe that you're developing something, and also may attract other kinds of resources and support.
You did mention that, you're the kind of person who's like, I have to have all the information. I have to know it's going to be perfect before I start. And I can imagine, since you were part of starting Idealist, that became quite a barrier.
Well, I was fortunate because, I was really, it was myself and Ami who were there at the time. And we were a very good, I think we were a very good team for one another. And we were both prepared to work exceedingly hard. And we had very different ways of seeing the world. So sometimes in a founding thing, having someone who provides a counterbalance to the way you see things can be incredibly helpful. Especially when, again, you can communicate across that difference versus getting, oppositional. So it's like one of those things where I think that helped. Okay. So I think we were talking a bit that one of the challenges that I see, this was areas where I get a little squirrely because I don't want to offer up, this is what I did idealist, and therefore this is the way you should do it. Because I think one of the great challenges is very often, I see this a lot in the kind of like VC world, but you see this thing where someone has been successful with an organization doing one thing, and therefore they believe that the secret for anyone to be successful is to do that one thing. And so I'm actually much less of a here's the way you have to do it. And I'm much more of a, let's talk about the process for making a decision. Let's talk about how you own how you own getting to know enough information, because ultimately it's on you to take the responsibility for that. So it's a lot more of that. Like I will always talk to people about like comps. So what is a comparable thing to what you're looking to do? So especially in the sort of nonprofit social enterprise world, let's say you're looking to launch a new program that like has that's a, like a public health program that has chapters across the country, and has a particular way of funding itself. What happens most often for some reason is that people do the landscape analysis that's focused on peer organizations and public health. And that's helpful, right? You want to know the landscape of who's out there. But knowing how a group that's in environmental work or that's in, you know, youth soccer or whatever, that has the same structure of it's national, it funds itself in this way, it has a particular kind of mission focus, is incredibly helpful for understanding how to structurally create and develop something. So it's more like, I actually think people spend a lot of time knowing what are all the other groups that are like me working in the space, which again, important. If there's no void and that's an oversubscribed area, probably not a lot of reason for you to do what you're doing. However, in order to understand how something becomes successful, you can learn an awful lot by seeing, you know, these comps of things that aren't your issue area, but are close enough by key things that are important to you. So like that for me, I nerd out on a spreadsheet. I love weighted choice making. I love Venn diagrams. Like my head naturally goes to those sorts of structures, which I think is very confusing for folks because I am like the most unassuming person in certain respects. So they're just like, oh, it's weird that your head is so like structured around that versus like feelings.
Russ, I know you do a ton of leadership coaching for founders, executive directors, kind of in this social enterprise space. And if I were a betting person, there probably are some issues that emerge across most leaders, if not all leaders, regardless of what sector they're in. What are some of the key issues you're seeing right now?
I mean, for me, I think the one that comes up most often is probably the determination of whether one is doing a good job, whether one has had a good year, or like whatever you want to define success. And I think the challenge is very often people haven't done the work to figure out what success is for themselves. It may be that their boss, if they have a boss, hasn't done a great job, or their board hasn't done a great job of saying, here are the success metrics. But I think one of the challenges is that if you don't know what success is, you can create all different kinds of anxiety or guilt about I should do more. And especially when you're doing a thing that you care about very much, you always feel like you should do more, right? You can always feel like there that more, if I had been better or smarter or something, more would have happened. And so I think that that idea of how you set those goals is incredibly important. And even if it turns out that the goals that you set were ultimately the wrong ones, the fact that you know, at least, hey, if I have a goal, I can realize a goal, for most people is incredibly helpful. So I think that's a big thing that I think comes up a lot. Going back to the sort of the VCs and the one way to do things, I think who you listen to is a challenge. There's a segment of folks who are in constant conversations with people. It doesn't always move the work forward. And what it often does is it creates the last person I spoke with is the person I'm listening to. And that's changing because they're constantly in conversation. And so on some level, oftentimes what you need to do is you need to kind of pick your horse. Who am I going to listen to? Why am I going to listen to them? So you can at least go down a path, and you know it's your responsibility to figure it out. Who's that person I respect enough, trust enough, communicate well enough with, and that I believe is going to be there in a continual way for the work. I think that's another really messy piece for people.
So for me, this brings up a couple questions, and I have to tell you a quick story before I can ask the first question. So early in my career as an executive director, I had a great board chair, and I talk about her a good little bit, Rhonda K.R. Cook. I learned so much about leadership from Rhonda. And I always remember, and Rhonda, you know, Rhonda is one of those people who's like, okay, here's a good way, let's all do this way. But she's also very, very convincing with it. And so it does not feel forced at all. It really does not feel forced. And so Rhonda's like, okay, Dolph, it's the start of a new year. We need you to develop three goals. If all you achieve are these three goals this year, you know you were successful. And by the way, she also did that with every committee. She's like, we need every committee to have three goals. And if all they achieve are just those three goals, hey, they were successful. You don't need to worry about anything else. You did what you needed to get done. So I know for a lot of people, if they don't have someone or some entity like a board that says to them, here's what your goals are, actually creating a limited number of goals is hard. How do you help people do that?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways that I tend to approach it. And I do this with a number of folks. I actually, for most of the founders that I work with, I tend to go into the muck of both their professional and personal lives. I try to work on a broad set of things that are about work, but also life outside of work, that they're doing things that are sustaining them as well there. The way that I find it to be most helpful is, I mean, one, you have to know what the programs are in a really meaningful way. And the challenge is, you know, I can't give you an actual accurate percentage of the number of board chairs that actually are that equipped to understand the nature of programs. But for me, a lot of it comes down to spending a lot of time with people to understand their programs, to develop trust. There's two things going on in my head right now. So one is, I will have conversations when I onboard the fellows for next year. I'll say, hey, if we're talking a year from now, and what would be like one or two things that would make you feel good that you accomplished in this year? In part because in a fellowship application, people talk about the stuff they're going to do, and like, given the amount of money and the amount of coaching they have and the other stuff that's going on, there's almost no way they're ever going to do those things. Because it's just like, because, you know, you're applying, you're trying to sound big, huge, impressive. And so I just try to say like, hey, let's kind of boil this down to a couple of things and make it easier, even if just based on the application. But in truth, when I'm really working in a closer way with a founder, it's really getting in much deeper on a whole set of programmatic things and then actually moving ahead with what are the goals, because sequencing is so incredibly important, right? The challenge is like, what is the sequential order of the things you're doing? What else needs to be in place? What other relationships or approvals? Like, all this stuff is so interconnected. So, you know, when a board chair is asking for something like that, it's a big open question. The best thing about a good manager, I think, is that, you know, aside from their being affirming and engaging and thinking about your growth, is that they can take a look at a plan and they can say, hey, let's take a look at all these things. I'm aware of your work. And let's look at the sequencing, the cadence. Let's say, you know, this thing probably it's not going to make sense this year or this quarter, and kind of can give you permission to move stuff off. I'm a huge permission person with people, because I think one of the things that's hard is often we tell ourselves we want to get all the things done. So I was telling you that I just moved. I had two pods that arrived and were moved out of on Sunday. And in the past, when I move into a place, I could be up all night putting everything away, because I like to, I didn't say that was a good thing. I just said that was a thing I did. And so like this time I was like, you know, do you really like need to go and set yourself up for that? Does it make that much of a difference? And I was like, okay, I'm telling myself I'm going to set up the office. So I'm going to set up the office, I have a place to work. I'm going to start off having one good, solid, clean space with a door I can close. So I can feel surrounded by order of some sort. And so sometimes it's just like my giving myself permission to say, you know what? I did that yesterday. I was set today. I got up early this morning to finish the rest of it. And I'm good. I gave myself permission to focus on that. And so I think sometimes it's just a matter of saying to ourselves, what's the thing that giving ourselves permission to not feel like we have to do the super unrealistic thing very quickly? So whether it comes to like planning, et cetera, it's that, but often it's done in conversation, in collaboration with someone else who you know is invested in your success in some way.
So it's interesting because the other thing I really hear there is it's really sort of done in those bite-sized, doable chunks as well.
Yeah. Yeah, people create way too much anxiety about the thing that they should not be spending time on. I have a thing, one of the things that I have from my mom that I've learned is mostly she sets a great example for so many things. But there's one thing that I'm like, I cannot do. That's a thing that she'll do sometimes, which is spending a lot of time worrying about the bad thing that hasn't happened yet and may not happen at all. And so it's just like, it's some of it is just a lot. I just try to do whatever I can. I will go to the airport 4 hours early because I don't want to be late. And for me, that's fine. Like, I have no problem with that. I'm like, that's okay. I just do what I can to sort of like create a cadence, do something that's realistic and kind of build them that way. But yeah, it is a lot of like understanding who you are, how you work, how it impacts other people, and what's going to best set you up for success. So if I'm working with a founder, some founders work really well when you hyperstructure them. Some founders don't do very well with that structure. They're great at building trust in that relationship, but having them follow a plan, a process is harder. And so, you know, you have to make a decision, like, am I the right person with that person? And sometimes I'm just like, yeah, it could still work. I just have to pivot and adapt with them, given who they are and how they show up in the world.
Okay. Well, Russ, speaking of pivoting and adapting, it is time for us to adapt to the next section. I say pivot all the time, so I'm like, okay, I'm going to say adapt to the next section of our podcast episode. And that's where we're going to get to play Two Truths and a Lie, which, by the way, so far I've been remarkably bad at. So I'm hoping that you're going to share two truths and a lie, not necessarily in that order, of course, and I will try to guess which one is the lie.
So one is, I studied abroad in then Yugoslavia. When we were there, we met up with an international touring group of professional wrestlers that was being sent home because it was no longer deemed safe to be in the country because there were issues with Albania. As we were preparing to go and stay and study for the next 3 to 4 months. Number two is my uncle of similar last name was a writer on LA law. And actually, I spent some time for a little while because I was thinking about going to Hollywood and writing scripts and perhaps following in the family business, as it were. And the last one, I had an opportunity to be in a book where I was going to be painted in the nude by Salman Rushdie.
So I think the studying in Yugoslavia, professional wrestlers, tensions with Albania feels too bizarrely specific to be anything but the truth. So I think that is the truth, or one heck of a good well-spun lie. I don't know which, but I'm going to go for the truth.
Okay.
I do think, and so now it's a toss-up. I'm like, which is it? The Salman Rushdie painting or LA Law? I'm going to guess that I don't know that Salman Rushdie is a painter. Maybe Salman Rushdie is, but I don't know. So I'm going to guess that you do have an uncle who is a writer or was a writer for LA Law, and you considered following that path. And the lie would be Salman Rushdie's painting book.
There is, in fact, a writer from LA Law with the last name Finkelstein, but I'm not related to them, unfortunately. Salman Rushdie, exactly. Salman Rushdie thing, it's true. There was this weird French art publishing house. I had a friend who was the editor-in-chief, and they were doing a book of cards, playing cards. He was going to design a specific thing that would be drawn on me while I was in the nude. Unfortunately, work called me away. Idealist work called me away, so I wasn't ultimately able to do it. But that was a particular, my friend was very eager for me to get in the book. And he was like, what would it take to get you? And he was like, I can get Salman Rushdie. And I was like, well, if you get Salman Rushdie, I'll do it. But it didn't work out because I probably had to do like a career fair or a grad school fair or something that brought me away instead. But yes, that was actually true.
Was Rushdie also a painter?
I would say for the sake of this particular effort, I don't know if that skill was super important. Like I have no, it would have been just really, really, really weird. But there's a part of me that kind of likes weird. So like, sure, it's super random. Like, of course I would try that.
Yeah.
Of course I would say yes to that.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And obviously that story already can make you like the monarch of two truths and a lie. But, you know, either way, you'd be the monarch of two truths and a lie. Well, Russ, thank you so much for coming on and really sharing some phenomenally good advice around getting past our fear and setting goals for leaders and executive directors. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to help always. So yeah, thanks for having me.
All right. And friend, this is the interesting thing. Russ is one of those people who kind of flies under the radar. So I don't have a URL or a website for Russ, but you can visit Russ at LinkedIn. And we're going to also connect to Russ's LinkedIn page on the show notes because LinkedIn has such long URLs. So if you go to successfulnonprofits.com, we will post a link to his LinkedIn page in the show notes. And if you found this episode useful, there's two more that I think you are going to get a lot out of. The first is episode 187, Coaching for Nonprofit Leaders with Deb Stallings. And the second is episode 310, Navigating Nonprofit Leadership Transitions. That, my friends, is our show for this week. I hope that you have gained some insight to help you and your nonprofit thrive. And the lawyers make me say it, because otherwise I would have stopped 100, 200 episodes ago. I'm not an accountant, nor am I an attorney. And neither I, nor the consulting practice, nor this podcast provide tax, legal, or accounting advice. You guessed it, friend. That means this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied on for tax, legal, and accounting advice. Please, if that is what you need, find a licensed, qualified person and get the counsel you seek.